I will have to do my presentation in English, and I appreciate your patience. And I also want to thank Pierrick for all the work he did organizing this, and for Dr. Brunel for inviting me. And I'm going to be talking about global framework agreements. I want to start by saying why global framework agreements. I think global framework agreements are probably one of the most important developments in global social dialogue and international global industrial relations in probably most of the, its whole era. So it's important for us to pay attention, to see where they are going well, what problems they create, what opportunities and best practices they provide. So I'm going to break up my presentation to three parts. I want to provide an overview of global framework agreements. Then I want to discuss these agreements as outputs and outcomes. And finally, connect these agreements to public labor governance. And before doing that, let me tell you a little bit about the source of information and examples I will be using. This is information that comes from my own research over the last 10 years on global labor politics and framework agreements, but most importantly, from a collaboration with a project which is based at the University of Berlin under the directorship of Dr. Fichter and Sido, which examines the implementation of global agreements in Brazil, in Turkey, in India, and in the United States. I have been working on the United States, but also I've been lucky enough to have learned about the implementation and the impact of those agreements in those other countries and beyond. So I'll be, whenever I use examples, they will be from my experience and work in the United States, but I want you to know that this is embedded within a broader view of global framework agreements. Let me start with an overview. What are the minimal characteristics? Generally speaking, the minimal characteristic that's an agreement between a company and signed by a global union federation. But for most of the time, most of those agreements are negotiated by the home country union, perhaps by an employee organization, and quite frequently GAFs are very intimately involved, sometimes more, sometimes less, and I think Jim will knows more about that. I'll talk a little bit about the trajectory of framework agreements, the sectoral coverage and the geography. Let's look at the global framework agreements by year. As you can see, the first agreement, which was not really thought of as a global framework agreement, was with Danone in 1988, and since then, Danone has signed 7 or 8 agreements over time, the most recent 2011. It's a special kind of agreement. But generally speaking, we can see that the process towards global framework agreements starts in 1998, late 1990s, and we should pay attention not only to how many agreements have been signed per year, but also how many of them have been renegotiated. So you can see that the number of agreements, the yellow, are agreements that have been renegotiated. You can also see that the number of agreements increased and then slowed down when global union federations and unions decided that perhaps some of the earlier practices and agreements were not as strong and they had to become a little bit more profound. By global union federation, I have not synthesized here ICEM, IMF, and the garment union, global union federation, now they're one, industrial. But you can see that about 24% are in the industrial sector, IMF, and then you put ICEM. So about more than 40% of the agreements are in the manufacturing and industrial sector. And then you add to that the Building and Woodworkers International, construction, and some industry. And then about 30% are in services. You add to that the IUF, the food workers. It's about 35%. So the service sector is growing as well. In terms of home countries, of course, global framework agreements have been criticized in the past because they were primarily European. So there have been efforts to globalize the origin of those companies. And you can see that a number of companies are from other parts of the world, 5 of them, for instance, from Brazil. So that's worth noting. And since I'm here, I decided to do a little bit of research, additional research. So I went to all 93 websites of all the companies that have signed global framework agreements to find out whether they have subsidiaries in North America and specifically in Canada, in the United States, and Mexico. As you can see, out of those 93 companies, about 90, let us say some agreements are not functional any longer, 22 do not have a presence in North America. In terms of Canada, 41 do not have a presence in Canada, so they're not immediately relevant, but as part of North America, probably Canada should be concerned. About 50 of them not in Mexico, and then in the USA, 24 companies that have global framework agreements do not have operations in the United States. Many of them are small. Some of them are very, very big, particularly service kinds of companies, telecommunications. They haven't made it from France, for instance, haven't made it yet to these markets. Peugeot is another example. So how should one study global framework agreements? I think it should be, they should be studied as a dynamic and contested process, not just as sort of static regulatory instruments. We should look at them as policy outputs, as policy scientists use the term. What are they? And as policy outcomes. What happens once they are operational over a period of time? How are they changed? So let's talk about global framework agreements as outputs. Fichter, Sydow, and Helfen from the University of Berlin have distinguished between hollow, modifying, and creative global framework agreements. You can imagine hollow are really don't mean much. Modifying, they change things a little bit. And creative, they really try to think out of the box. And they do that by looking at participation. They look at the content of those agreements, and they look at the intensity. Let me very quickly talk about some of those topics. Participation. Who participates in the negotiation of those agreements? And that's a very interesting question, as we find out. At the level of management, at the level of unions, quite frequently those agreements, always, they are centrally negotiated at headquarters. Subsidiaries either don't know about them, local managers even less so, and often they are opposed to them. So when the time comes for implementation, you can understand that creates some very serious problems. Workers, the same thing. Unions, employee organizations, global union federations, European works councils, and a few global works councils, well, they may have different interests. And there might be different interests between home and host country. So who participates in the negotiation of those agreements is really a complicated issue. It should not be reduced management and labor. So which management and which labor? When is participation taking place? If you are a union in a host country, are you involved at all in the negotiation of an agreement that may actually affect you? And a number of American unions, U.S. unions, and unions elsewhere in the world have complained, properly so, that they learn about those global framework agreements only once they have been signed, or they know that something is going on, but they were not included. So the unions, the global union federations, have been working on that with some improvements. And how do you participate? Are you being consulted, informed, or do you participate in the negotiations? Do you shape the agreement? So those are very important questions, and in fact, in our research, we see them playing a very, very important role. They're not sort of abstract, untested questions. The content of the agreements, the range of rules. Different countries have different kinds of industrial relations standards, different kinds of arrangements. It is not possible to capture this historical diversity by just coming up with a cookie-cutter approach. You have to be sensitive to different issues. So, for instance, Europeans, some Europeans are familiar with works councils, employee organizations at the level of the enterprise. Well, for some American unionists, that would be a kind of co-optation if not properly informed. So there can be some very serious problems there. Is there the emphasis on labor rights, labor standards, or managerial prerogatives, like restructuring, for instance? Do those agreements apply to? Do they apply globally, or are there exceptions? Now, those exceptions may be, of course, China. One would think of China immediately. One could think of India. But one should really think of the southern United States, the right-to-work states in the southern United States, and increasingly with the new labor law, Mexico. From our research, we have found that the right-to-work states, the anti-union states in the United States, combined with the anti-union movement that is going on in Mexico right now, which is exemplified by the new labor law, is as serious a problem as is China in the long term. So let's bring into the mix this particular possibility. But also we have to ask, do they apply to partners? Do they apply to the supply chain? Do they apply to distributors in the United States? 25% of the auto industry is unionized. Well, that's misleading. is 25% of the manufacturing sector of the auto industry. It's about 1 million. The whole auto sector in the United States employs more than 4 million people, if you include dealers, mechanics, car washers. I just found out myself, 150,000 car washers. Well, the number changes significantly, right? So we have to look at that. In talking about partners, it's very interesting to note Peugeot Citroën, it's not in North America. Hardly can see them there. But they do have a totally owned subsidiary for Asia that creates supplies, that operates throughout the Americas. But somehow, when the agreement was negotiated, for Asia was left out. That's a very serious problem that has created some controversial situations in the United States. We have to look at the intensity of the situation. I have gone 20 minutes, so I have 5 minutes. The intensity of negotiations, how profound they are, the strength of the organizational arrangements, legal grounding. I do not see GFAs as legal agreements. But then we have to look at global framework agreements as outcomes. What happens to participation, to institutional arrangements, to their content across time? Are they a living instrument? Are they a living institution or something that sort of remains frozen? We should look at the outcomes of global framework agreements, not only in a regulatory sense, but have they helped in terms of unionization? Have they helped in changing the attitudes of the corporation? And also, have they had an impact on changing the attitudes of unions? So those are some of the things. Now, to go to the last part, which is to connect global framework agreements with labor governance. Three questions: responsibility or accountability, dialogue or joint decision-making, private or public labor governance. I think there are varieties of corporate social responsibility, and the one that we should pay attention to is not philanthropy, is not reaction kind of corporate social responsibility, but it's strategic corporate social responsibility, where corporations actively try to engage their workers in micro-corporate arrangements, or they actually try to change the policies at the global level, perhaps through the International Organization for Standardization. So if unions and corporations participate in that, they legitimate CSR. How can you move beyond CSR? And I'm glad Mr. Baker is here. One solution is to connect global framework agreements with other kinds of principles, such as the RAGI standards. So that'd be worth talking about. There's a lot of discussion about social dialogue in Europe and global social dialogue. Well, there are different kinds of social dialogue. Some of it is just we're talking, nothing happens. But I think social dialogue that becomes joint decision-making is very important. And we have found a number of instances where, in fact, one could talk about joint decision-making as a result of global framework agreements. Danone, of course, is one example. Rhodia is another example that one could pay attention to. Some degree, Daimler is another example. Interestingly enough, the service industry, the Securitas and ISS and G4S, for a variety of reasons. Ultimately, I think that if global framework agreements remained at the level of the corporation, there are no patterns, they don't promote common rules, they are not connected to public authority, they could become an obstacle to public regulation. On the other hand, if they are pursued strategically, one can see the possibility that essentially they will create some kind of customary set of practices, of best practices, that could conceivably, and this is hypothetical, would contribute to some kind of public regulation, whether that's extraterritorial or at the global level. And to conclude, I think global framework agreements are a key development in global labor governance, whose regulatory potential should not be exaggerated. They should not be looked at as a sort of a law or some kind of statute that just needs to be implemented. What we should pay close attention to is their impact on unions, on corporations, and most importantly, on the relations between the two over time. Thank you.